5 minutes ago. What did I talk about? I have trouble with that. You tell me what we talked about last week.
Law of Return.
Yes, you heard the tape. Yes, we heard.
We mixed some stuff. Law of Return and Who is a Jew issue.
Right, you weren't even here. That's great.
I listened to the recording.
You were channeling us. Law of Return, Who is a Jew, which are very related issues.
Brother Daniel Case,
who was a Polish Jew who converted when he was being hidden during the war, wanted to become an Israeli citizen because of the Law of Return. Remember what the government said?
The government said no.
That he could not.
Right. As they say in sports, he went to the other team. Right. So when you go to the other team, you don't get the bat for us.
Correct.
Basically. Correct. So that's, which is not the Jewish religious law opinion, which we discussed. Right? According to Halakha, he was a Jew.
Right. If your mother's a Jew.
Right. Doesn't matter what you do.
Yeah.
Want to go eat some pork on Yom Kippur?
Mm-hmm.
You're a Jew. You want to go convert to whatever? You're a Jew. You might, in my view, no longer be part of the Jewish people, but according to Jewish law, you're a Jew.
So, according to Halakha, you're always a Jew.
No. Basically. Now, a rabbinical court can get together under certain circumstances and kind of...
from the Orthodox.
Yes. Orthodox. And drum you out of the court. Well, you know, I would say that the vast majority of the conservative rabbis accept it as well. You know, that I know of.
So, even if you're the, Jewish cardinal, you're not Jewish.
That is correct. Lustiger from France.
Neil said that Israeli government will accept a convert who converted according to conservatism?
If it's done outside of Israel. Not if it's done in
Israel.
You are accepted under the Law of Return to get instant citizenship because you're a Jew. But if that conversion were performed in Israel, it's not valid to the state. At this point, and despite some court rulings that would beg to differ, there's practical matters, there's legal matters, there's religious matters. They're all different.
What about excommunication?
There is an excommunication in Judaism. It's called a cherem. Now, you can be in cherem and still be a Jew. Spinoza was given a cherem. I read the decree, and it was fascinating. You got to walk on the other side of the street of him. You can't talk to him. You can't talk to anybody who talks to him. Yeah, but Spinoza was a Jew.
But he was a Jew.
He was just considered a really bad Jew. And he was drummed out of the community. So that's an instance where, you know, they can't override Jewish law, but the practicality of it is you can't communicate with him anymore.
So theoretically, if he went to Great Britain, he could have rejoined that community.
Yes, but, and the but is, if the rabbis in Amsterdam had sent a letter to the rabbis in London, it would have been over for him.
Yeah. Couldn't have joined the shul.
What?
Couldn't have joined the shul.
Depends on how much money he has. Depends on the donation, let's get serious. So we talked about a lot of those types of cases, and it's an ongoing debate, and we talked about the Orthodox and the power of the Orthodox. And we're actually going to keep returning to that theme of orthodoxy periodically because it's played, A, such an interesting role in the development of the state, but B, it's increasingly important in the state. You know, if you want to combine the modern Orthodox and the Haredi Orthodox, you know, by the UD in political terms, I think has 17 seats now, and the Haredi parties, if you, Shas and the United Torah, have about 15 seats. So you could be talking 20 to 30% of the electorate. That's a swing, and it's not being reduced. It was put off, by the way, these big questions for a while in the 90s because of the Soviet/Russian immigration. You know, you get a million non-Orthodox Jews coming to the country. That put off certain questions for a while. But they're coming back. They're coming back. We'll see some of that tonight. Anything else from last week?
Leibovitz?
Oh, yeah, Yeshayahu Leibovitz. Very, you know, fire and brimstone. You know, really fascinating, kind of contrarian, you know, very observant in his personal life, just despises the state, basically, in most of what it does. And you remember, anybody remember his famous word for the Western Wall?
Disco.
The Discotel.
the Discotel. A great line. And he called the worship of the Western Wall Avodah Zarah, or idol worship. He said it was a retaining wall. We used to dump garbage against it. And this you worship? That's not God. You know, he says that's not more significant than anything else. But, you know, people need a focal point. All right.
Lansky, you talked about Lansky.
Oh, yeah, Mayor Lansky, our buddy.
I had a question. He helped a great deal in the formation of state as far as...
I wouldn't say a great deal, but some.
Did they consider that? They
were that was his personal appeal to Prime Minister... that wasn't Begin at that. It was Goldemeyer. That was his personal appeal to Goldemeyer. Look what I did for you guys. Absolutely. He did many other things, too, in his life.
Yeah.
You know? You can't have a good Tuesday and forget about Wednesday, right? Oh, that's on a short lease tonight. Okay. So we are on part two of really state building, state institutions, and the like. Tonight we're going to talk about... Actually, we're not going to really talk about the rabbinate that much tonight because we've done a lot of that already. And we might come back to it, but... You know, that is obviously one of the pillars of the state institution. It's a nice picture of the Knesset, the government, Israeli law, the Ministry of Education, the military, and actually we're probably not going to get into this stuff that much, government-owned and heavily controlled businesses. Wow. Let's see if I can get rid of that. There we go. It does work. She said it didn't work. All right, so the government. Government of Israel is... obviously, unlike the government of the United States, right? It is a parliamentary democracy. What do we have?
Bicameral legislature.
Yes. Do we have a democracy?
A republic.
A republic. That is correct. Correct. In fact, when was the last time the world really had a democracy? Anybody know?
Greece.
Yeah. Athens. Really, and by the way, that wasn't really a democracy because women didn't vote. Right?
Or slaves,
of course, which was the foundation of their culture. There's an executive branch. It's divided just like in this country. We have an executive, a judicial, and a legislature. Prime minister. Twice in the history of Israel, the prime minister of Israel was elected by popular ballot, just like here. I think it was 93 or 94, they changed the law, which used to be, and is again, that the head of the party with the most votes is the one who is asked by the president to form a coalition. And I think that person has, I believe, 45 days, 45 or 60, I think we have a coming up slide, to do so. They wanted to try something. This was literally the being half pregnant thing. There was a lot of consideration and pushed by groups like the Israel Democracy Institute, the IDI, and Aryeh Carmon, if any of you know of him, to have Israel go to representation from geographic districts, like we have in this country, and to have direct election for the prime minister, like we have for the president. They didn't want to do geographical representation, because it would have been a political nightmare. Nobody would have agreed to it, basically. Because what happens, by the way, we've been talking about the Orthodox. What happens to the Orthodox, particularly the Haredi parties, if you only have geographical representation? Where do they come from? Where do they have seats?
Jerusalem.
And nothing else. So their overall percentage of influence on the electorate drops. And, you know, similar with some other groups as well. So they did it twice in 96. When Netanyahu was elected, and in 99 when Ehud Barak was elected, it didn't work. Actually, voter representation dropped. Now, Israel has generally very high turnout for elections. It'll go between the low 60s to the low 70s. You know, we can only dream of that in this country. If we had 50%, we're ecstatic. Right? What was it in the last gubernatorial election here? 28, 30%, something like that? I mean, really embarrassing. In 2001, that law was changed. Menachem Begin put offices in East Jerusalem,
in the late 1970s to stick a thumb in the eye of the world, which was upset about it. So the official prime minister's offices are both in East Jerusalem and West Jerusalem. The main office is in West Jerusalem. And it's not far from the Knesset. Some of you might have passed it. Anyone ever been in that complex? It's very, very nice.
Which
the prime minister's, yeah.
The prime minister's office.
Yeah.
I've been past it.
Yeah. Ministries for the party and reward for entering the coalition. You enter the coalition with a certain thing in mind. If you are the Shinui party, the very secular party in the late 90s and the early 2000s, your goal is to maintain control, or to get control of the Ministry of the Interior so you can secularize all the walls. If you're Shas or United Torah, your goal is to get the Ministry of Religion and the Ministry of the Interior so that you can make everything religious. And you're going to make demands on entering the coalition. And there's going to be a coalition agreement signed. Very unlike what we have here. And I once heard, I don't know if any of you know, Reuven Chazan. He's a political scientist at Hebrew University. And he had a great comment. Somebody said to him, your system seems so dysfunctional. Does it really work? And he said, don't think of it as dysfunctional. Think of it as different. In fact, I'll make the argument to you that we are more democratic than you are, because look at the different types of people that are represented by our political parties. You have Democrats and Republicans. Right? We have modern Orthodox, ultra-Orthodox, Russian speakers, secular, West Bank settlers, Arabs, and so on and so on. You can make that argument. You know, whether or not that's healthy is a different conversation. Whether or not it's representative, it certainly is. If you want, you can create new ministries. For example, in 1984, a disgraced Ariel Sharon wanted back in the coalition in Yitzhak Shamir's Likud party. So what they did, he was disgraced because in 1982, the Lebanon War, the Kahan Commission had come out with a ruling of the Sabra and Shatila saying that he bore indirect responsibility, and he was forced to resign that position. So you created, what was it, the Ministry of Infrastructure. Now, the Ministry of Infrastructure was great for him because he got a big budget and he could push settlements, some of which he would dismantle when he became prime minister 20 years later, which was kind of interesting. You can create a lot of deputy ministries. There has been some legislation afoot to limiting the amount of ministers and deputy ministries that you can have for an obvious reason. It costs a lot of money, right? But this is political patronage at its finest. What most people don't realize is you need not be a member of Knesset to be a minister in the Israeli government. Just like in this country, you're not a member of Congress. Actually, nobody's a member of Congress if they serve in the cabinet now. But in Israel, basically, there's only been one who has not been a member of the Knesset, Yaakov Nehemiah. He's the most prominent, I should say. There's been a few others. He was the finance minister for Netanyahu from 96 to 99, and then he did it again a little bit the last few years. He's a very capable individual, never been elected to the Knesset. And there is a law afoot now in Israel, which may or may not get through the system, saying that if you serve in the cabinet, you have to resign your Knesset seat. Now, why would Netanyahu want that, by the way? Why would a prime minister not want his members of his cabinet to be part, or her cabinet, to be part of the Knesset? Any thoughts on that?
Well, loyalty.
Loyalty? Yeah, absolutely. There's another thing, too.
They come to the meetings and they know too much and then they go back and can influence the Knesset.
You're on the right track, but part of the issue is they're not at the Knesset that much.
Oh.
They miss a lot of votes because they're doing this job. Right? And that's why sometimes if you read the Israeli papers, you'll see it passed 32 to 14. And you'll say, wait a minute, there was like 120 people. And Knesset, well, half of them were out being ministers, you know, opening a plant up in Haifa or something like that. Cabinet meets on Sunday morning. It's always good every Sunday morning when you're having your cup of coffee or tea to open Jerusalem Post, Haaretz, Yediot Ahronot, Times of Israel, and see what they decided at the cabinet meeting. I always do that. It's always interesting because, of course, they're 6 or 7 hours behind us. The prime minister, just like here, gets to pick kind of his inner cabinet, his security cabinet. And a lot of people want to be in that, and it's usually only 3 or 4 people. Right? It's always the prime minister. It's always the minister of defense. Chief of staff. That usually a head of Shin Bet or Mossad will sit in on that. You may get 1 or 2 others in there. Very small. Those are the people that either make the, you know, confidential decisions or make a decision and say, now let's bring it to the cabinet. So that's an important group. And part of coalition bargaining is to be in that group. It's very influential. And if you're in that group, by the way, it's a stepping stone. I mentioned the Norwegian law proposal, a guy named Yossi Behlen, who was very liberal, one of the behind-the-scenes architects of the Oslo Accords in 1992, 93, and Netanyahu was said to favor when he was prime minister in 96, was again cabinet ministers resign from the Knesset to serve. And what do you guys think of that idea, by the way? Good? Bad?
They're serving one master rather than
right, two. And that's good for Netanyahu, right? And it's harder to pull out of a hopefully you're going to get people who aren't willing to pull out of a coalition so quickly because they want their job. They're not going to be back in Knesset.
Well, it's negotiated, right? It's not the prime minister who just selects those people, right? It's the coalition
correct
negotiates.
Correct. Now he has the final say, but it's part of a negotiating process.
Right.
And there's a negotiating team that goes out to each party after the elections.
So it is a little more theoretically balanced, you know, rather than just like here, where the president gets to, I mean, it's got to get approved, I guess, by Congress.
Right, Congress has to approve it. And of course, here, every president always tries to pick at least one person from a different party so they can say they're bipartisan. Whoops. All right. So, the Prime Minister's office oversees actually many diverse offices. Obviously oversees the ministries. There's the Atomic Energy Commission, which Israel has. They don't, technically don't have nuclear... No, actually, technically they do have nuclear power, right? They have always said that they have nuclear power. It's just not that they have the bombs and they're not doing any research. They never said they didn't have nuclear power.
No, what they said is they'd never be the first to introduce nuclear weapons.
Nuclear weapons, right. That's what I'm saying, nuclear power. The Mossad, the Shin Bet, which is the domestic security, something called the National Economic Council, something called the Israel Archives, offices like that. It's a big operation, just like we have in this country here. So that's the Prime Minister's office. Any questions on that? Okay. Now we get to the Knesset. Anybody know what Knesset HaGadolah was?
It's a big Knesset.
That was the ancient gathering of the Jewish sages and scholars. And that's why we have the name Knesset.
And when did that happen?
Well, it probably ceased to exist in 132, 135. Maybe 70. I'm not entirely sure.
Bar Kokhba.
Okay. Bar Kokhba was 132, 135. 70 was the first revolt. What they called the Great Revolt. Well, actually, Bar Kokhba was the Great Revolt. So that's where it comes from. Remember that the Zionists skip all of Jewish history after 135, right? Jewish history goes for them from 135 CE to 1882, when those 14 Ukrainian Russian Jews from Kharkov in the Bilu come to the land of Israel and settle as the first modern settlers. First, it was in Tel Aviv. Obvious reasons, Jerusalem was in a war situation. And it had two other locations in Jerusalem, Some of you may have walked by the Jewish Agency for Israel building in Jerusalem. We talked about it once, I think, in this class. Right next to that, there's a plaque on one of the buildings that says this is where the first Knesset met. Its current site went up in 66. It was actually in 58 when Baron James Rothschild, which was the son of the great Baron Rothschild, who set up a lot of the collective settlements and, you know, from the late 1880s to the 1930s. February 14th, 49, following the elections, the Knesset replaced the Provisional State Council. 120 seats, 12 tribes of Judah, 12 times 10. You know, people always ask me, why do they have 120 seats? Why not 100 seats? Because everything in Israel is symbolic of something. Absolutely everything. Right? It means something. And if not, they'll find a reason for it to mean something. Knessets rarely last their four-year terms. We talked last week, there are going to be new elections coming up on March 17th. At any point, like in any parliamentary democracy, they can be dismissed with a no-confidence vote. First, the prime minister says, you know, I'm going to call for new elections, and then the Knesset technically votes on it. Now, when two parties pulled out of this coalition last week, there was no longer a majority in the Knesset. The no-confidence motion was no question. By the way, anybody know how many readings a bill has to have in Knesset?
Three,
correct. If they have three readings, this gives you an opportunity to do some political jockeying between readings. Now, we have a similar system in this country, right? We have a committee, and there's some input, and then we have debate, and then we have to negotiate between the House and the Senate, so nothing winds up the way it starts, just like here. So there are similarities, but it's a different system. Parties actually list 120 people on their ballots. When you go to vote, has anyone here ever voted in Israel? When you go to vote in Israel, you get a card that has a Hebrew letter on it. And the Hebrew letter symbolizes the party. And you know what it is, and you put it in the box, and they tally it up. I don't know if some are electronic now or not. I keep seeing the hand boxes. Although I miss, you know, when I was a kid, the ones that, the big curtain, you know, and the big metal arms and all that. You're technically voting for a party, but you know in advance who's on that list. Now, you can vote for any party. You don't have to be a member of a party, although a lot of people are members of parties. You get various benefits and get invited to various things and what have you. And you always see, and you'll start to see soon in Israeli newspapers, Likud signed up 25,000 people in the last month. You know, they're just people who aren't members of parties or people who are trading parties. In the middle of a Knesset, just like here, you can say, I'm no longer with Likud. I've now joined Labor. Now here, you can say, I'm no longer a Republican, I'm a Democrat. It happens periodically. Not often, but it happens.
You mean one of the people? One of the people.
One of the Knesset members. Okay. Yeah, one of the Knesset members. You can have a minority government. When Ehud Barak went to the Camp David 2 negotiations in late June 2000, the National Religious Party had pulled out of his government, and Sharansky's Yisrael Ba'aliyah Party had pulled out of his government. He had less than 60 seats in his government. But nobody wanted to call new elections. They wanted to see what would happen in Camp David, or they just weren't prepared for elections. He actually had a minority government. You can rule with a minority government. For example, in 1995, when what's called Oslo II or Oslo Bet, the second part of the Oslo Accords were passed, the Israeli Arabs were the ones who made it pass. They voted for it. There was a Jewish minority for that vote. So your whole coalition isn't always going to vote with you, because on certain matters you're going to say you're free to choose as you want, but on other matters you're going to say, if you don't vote for us, we're going to kick you out of the coalition. Questions? So it's been a complicated system, but it's their system. Some parties reserve seats. Part of their constitution or rules will say, you know, the Labor Party, for example, I know, has a thing for, there's always an Israeli Arab on their list in the top, I don't know, it's 15 or 20 or something like that. Some seats will hold party for women. Some seats will hold parties for an Ethiopian. Labor did that at one point. You know, and so on and so on. There's no reason why you can't do that. It's nothing.
Are the parties bound because of the, they provide the list?
Right.
125. Are they bound by the sequencing that they put
yes.
down?
Yes.
So if they get 10%, they get 12 seats. But if your number is
13,
but they can't shuffle it around and say, well, this an Arab was 15, we'll move them up.
That is correct. It is set by law. That's what you're voting for. However, if you have 10. And somebody in your list decides to go move to France, number 11. Exactly. From that past election. Number 11 says no, then it goes to number 12. The verse is here where we have special elections.
Right.
When somebody vacates a seat. Which should, you would think, adds to stability. All right. March 2014. I'll move that up and show you. See, that's actually a pretty important point. The threshold for who gets into the Knesset was moved up. When the state started, it was 1%. Right? You get 1% of the vote, you get a seat. Then it moved up to 2, then it moved up to 2.5. Now it's a 3.25, which does lock out a lot of smaller parties. So the question I have for you guys is good or bad for the Jews? Good or bad for the Jews to have a threshold keep creeping up? On the one hand, it's less democratic with a small d. On the other hand, it's less chaotic. I mean, we would have had, by the way, the Alei Yirok group in two elections ago. That's the Greenleaf Party. Anybody know what they were for? Legalization of marijuana. They got a surprising amount of votes a few elections ago. Alei Yirok, it's called. You know, which is kind of...
Is that all they're for?
Huh?
That's
basically it. That's basically it. But what did that tell you? It told you that it was a protest vote. That told you people weren't happy. But hey, Israelis still vote. Right? But, and they're still around. Anyway, what do you guys think of that?
Yeah.
Which is better? To have it up? Why?
Because it would be easier. The Jewish population is much larger,
mm-hmm.
and it would be easier to fill that 3.25%.
So it's better for the Jews, you're saying?
I think.
Okay.
Keeps out more splinter parties.
Yeah. Definitely keeps out splinter parties, but again, not as representative then of your country. Right? The Ethiopians could run a party, but they'd never make it. Good or bad for the Jews? I don't know. Now, the theory is it lends to stability.
Ask the Italians, who used to change governments every 2 years.
Yeah. There you go.
They
yeah,
had
right.
Indian parties, and there was no stability whatsoever.
Right. So, and then Berlusconi bought the system, and
right,
it was relatively stable.
And he got thrown in jail.
Right, that's right. But his girlfriend still visits him.
Right.
But you also get rid of, again, the marijuana party,
right?
Who, while it's only one vote, it can make it can distort things because
yes,
the single votes or the double votes have more disproportionate amount of power simply because it's only 120 members.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I generally think it's pretty good. I might not make it 3.25. I might make 2.5 or 3. I'm not
the
really
Italians
quite
have
sure
it until they raise it to 5%.
Right, right. And Israel has what I always term as a raucous democracy. You know, I like to twist the American joke and say that I went to a hockey game and a Knesset debate broke out. There are some people who are not allowed to run in elections for the Israeli government. You can't be anti-democratic, and you can't obviously call for overthrow of the state. So, of course, Arab parties are always investigated because certain legislators always want them and their Knesset members, like a guy named Ahmed Tibi, investigated. But I'll give you an example. I think it was about 15 years ago, a group called the Monarchist Party was banned by the Israel Elections Committee from running. The monarchist party said, we want to return Israel to the era of monarchy, because that is when Israel was at its strongest and greatest. So the Israel Elections Committee said, no thank you.
They also banned Koch.
They banned Koch for its racist ideology. And Kahana was actually censured from the Knesset. I don't know if he was technically thrown out, but his voting privileges, I believe, were taken away from him. I have to check into that.
Well,
I don't quite recall.
If you can't vote, what difference is it whether you're in the Knesset or not?
I'm not sure, to be honest with you. I don't know the legal parameters of what they do.
He was kicked out.
Yeah, I know he was censured at one point, but I wouldn't be surprised. And they were only in for one term. And then he was the only one that had that seat.
How about the Communist Party?
There is a Communist Party in Israel, Chadash. And Chadash used to be split between both Arabs and Jews. There were a lot of Jewish communists, a guy named Moshe Sneh, who was very prominent in the early days of the state. He was also a Zionist at the same time. Now it is primarily an Arab party. There still are a handful of Jews who are involved with it. But there is a Communist Party in Israel. And one of the Arab lawmakers, I believe, adheres to their ideology. I think they folded into one of the Arab parties. The Arab parties, by the way, do have some Jewish representation in their votership or in their meetings, you know, for whatever reason. It's, likewise, Labor has Israeli Arabs. And we saw, particularly when Ehud Barak ran for prime minister in 1999, Israeli Arabs voted in droves for him. So, all right. Knesset 2, responsibilities. Obviously, they have to pass all laws. Then the prime minister has to sign them, just like the president does here. They elect the president in a secret ballot. The president is a ceremonial post, and we'll get to that. So there's political jockeying going back and forth on that. The parties will nominate somebody. Prime minister approves the cabinet, supervises the work of the government. This is the Knesset. They do the no-confidence vote motions we spoke about. They elect something called the state comptroller. It's a very interesting office. This is the ombudsman of Israel. State comptroller is paid to do reports on the ministries and the prime minister office's operations. My wife is an auditor for Baltimore County. It's just like that. You audit what's going on. The government is not legally obligated to follow what the comptroller writes. And he or she does some serious, serious investigation work, and just amazing the amount of stuff that they find. It often creates headlines and things get done, but there are certainly other times when it's basically ignored. But it's an interesting office, and I think it's a very good thing that the government has that. Here's some of the committees. They have three main types. There's permanent committees, which are the ones you would expect. Finance, Foreign Affairs, Defense, and Immigration. There's special committees, just like we do in this country. The ones they've had in Israel are about drug abuse, rights of the child, and foreign workers, which is a big issue in Israel in the past decade or two. Parliamentary inquiry, dealing with matters of national importance. Just like after the Yom Kippur War, we had the Agronaut Commission, named for the chief Justice of the Supreme Court. After almost every war, including this past summer's, they have an inquiry commission to do what in business we would call lessons learned. Now, it's got a political edge on it very often, but that's what they wind up doing. Any questions on this?
Can the controller be dismissed, or is that...
Yes, that's something that the Knesset can do. Knesset appoints...
Not
the prime minister. And very often... the comptroller will criticize the Rosh Hamshala, the prime minister.
I gather that, unlike our congressmen, the Knesset members have lots of perks.
Get cars, they get budgets. They don't get apartments in Jerusalem, but they're definitely perks.
They don't have to sleep on the couch.
Right. There's serious travel budgets involved. You're always reading about them being all over Europe. They're in and out of this country. Absolutely. Look, it's a very prestigious thing, including in this country. You're a congressman, that's a big deal. You know, there are 435 of them.
out of 310 million.
What's that ratio?
Oh, I'm really not good at math.
Probably better to be, there are more representatives in Israel per person than the U.S.
Well, you got 120 out of about 7.2, 7.3 million.
Versus 400 out of
300. No, here it's closer to 600,000.
Well, here you have 535 total. Yeah.
Math is definitely not my forte.
Israeli law is really interesting. It's not unusual to hear a judge quote Jewish law, Turkish law, British law, American law, and Israeli precedents.
Sorry to interrupt that.
Yeah.
10 times more representation in the United States, one per 60,000.
Okay. Okay. I'm not a math guy, so you got to figure it out.
7 million divided by 120 is 58,333.
Well, I'm glad to hear
that. Yeah.
That's not
all
makes
all right. So, on the day that the state was declared, one of the first things that the Knesset did was it said that all the British law that we've had for the last 30 years is now our law. Because they had to adopt something. They didn't have time to say, let's study it. They figured, we'll figure that out later. We've lived with this law for the last three decades. The vast majority of people now living in this country lived with this law since they've been here. Let's do that. Personal status laws, which we've spent a lot of time talking about, marriage, divorce, whatever, is in the hands of the religious court of your community. So if you're Muslim, a Sharia court can decide. If you're a Christian, I do not know the equivalent of a Christian court, but I assume that a Christian clergyman, or depending on the denomination, clergy person, but probably not so much so in Israel, can decide. What?
Inquisition.
Some things came up which were very interesting. Some Yemenites, very few, to be fair, and some Ethiopians, men, came here with more than one wife. Came to Israel with more than one wife. What do you do? This is the way they've lived all their lives, and this is the way their community has been for many, many hundreds of years. So, what do you think Israel did?
Called them Mormons.
and they did an HBO special, and, you know, they made a miniseries. What do you think Israel did?
Ignored it.
Couldn't ignore it, because free press.
Did they allow it for the first generation?
That's exactly what happened. They basically said, and basically nobody who came over was under the age of like 8 million, who had more than one wife. You know, it's true. They were all, oh, this is the way we always did it. Da-da-da-da-da-da. But these are some of the dilemmas that they had to deal with when they were dealing with these very disparate populations coming in. They had to fit them into their legal system. Yeah.
Oh, I think the Sephardi ketubot still have a provision for a second wife. It has to be approved by the first wife. But it's in the ketubah.
Wow. I need to look that up. That's fascinating.
A friend of mine had one.
Don't worry. I can't afford it.
Oh, yeah. I'm not saying it. I'm just saying it's fascinating. What's that, David?
I can't afford the first one.
All right. So that's some of the stuff that's going on. Israel, as we know, does not have a constitution. The Declaration of Independence said, we're going to have a constitution. And then they said, we're going to do it within about a year. Well, that obviously hasn't happened. A guy that we're going to talk about soon, Aharon Barak, basically said all these things in the 90s, said all these things called basic laws are our de facto constitution. Let's not worry about writing a constitution. We have laws. So, it's what's called an uncodified constitution. Ben-Gurion didn't want a constitution because the religious said we need a halakhic state and the secular said we need a liberal democracy. They're never going to agree. They didn't agree then. Certainly not going to agree now. 1950, there's something called the Harari decision. It's named after a Knesset member of something called the Progressive Party. You know, in Israel, political parties come and go after a few elections. Yesh Atid won 17 seats in this election. It'll win 10 in the next. It'll win 4 to 6 in the one after that. And it'll fold into another party. Right? Kadima, 2 seats from what was originally, I think, 40 or something like that. Come and go.
We have two that just won't go away.
So basically, Harari said the Knesset's Constitution, Law, and Justice Committee will write basic laws. In 1998, Barak said the basic laws are the Constitution. These are the basic laws of Israel. The government, this is how the government runs. And you can look this up. The Israel government has a wonderful website. It's in English, Russian, and Hebrew. The state economy, the Knesset, human dignity and law, that's supposed to say. Jerusalem, that came up in the early 1990s, which basically says Jerusalem is the undivided capital of the Jewish state and the Jewish people, and you basically can't divide Jerusalem. Or if you're going to do that, you have to have a public referendum on it. And it has to be approved by, I want to say, 60%. I looked at it the other day. I can't remember. It's no 51%, I'll tell you that much. The president of the state, the military, the judiciary, state comptroller, freedom of occupation, and referendum. The referendum, again, on any lands that are given up. That's the latest one.
You skipped Israel lands. What does that mean?
Oh, Israel lands. There's something called the Israel Lands Authority. The state of Israel, you actually don't own the land that your house is on in Israel the way you do here for most people.
It's ground rent.
Yeah, it's ground rent. The state of Israel, either through the JNF or the state itself, owns the land and you lease it for, I don't know how long, it probably depends. That's why you might remember about a year or two ago, there was a big debate as to whether or not an Arab family could move into a Jewish neighborhood somewhere around Haifa. It wasn't in Haifa itself. And it became a big debate because the JNF owned that land. And was the JNF being racist by not allowing that to happen? So those cases come up periodically. Because the JNF said, no, you can't move in there. All right, the court system. Not surprisingly, Israel has a tiered court system just like we have here. They have magistrate courts. Those are small claims courts. But it's interesting, the division. These are cases where the accused face up to 7 years imprisonment. Maybe seven because of, you know, the significance of seven in Judaism, I'm not quite sure. Civil matters up to 2.5 million shekels. That always fascinates me because the value of the shekel changes so much. So, who knows? Traffic courts, municipal courts, family courts. After that come district courts. At least 7 years in imprisonment. So that this one was up to, and this was at least civil cases which more than 2.5 million shekels are in dispute. You can appeal the magistrate courts here, and so on. You can do petitions against arms of the government. That's where it starts. After that comes, by the way, this is the labor court in Jerusalem. Labor courts. You want to sue your employer? I mean, labor is a hotly disputed issue in Israel because of the unions. Strikes, disputes, national insurance, national health insurance law, you name it. That goes to labor courts. There are military courts. If you are in the army, you can be put on trial for disobeying orders. Soldiers all the time are put in jail for a couple days or whatever. You know, I was drunk on the base, I disrespected my commanding officer,
I was in 1986 in Israel when a program called Volunteers for Israel. For a month, you take the place of an Israeli soldier working in an army base. The theory is you free them up to go do what they're going to do. The commander of our group was leaving every afternoon to go work at his business in Haifa, and he left me in charge. Great, you know, spoke a little Hebrew, was with a bunch of American Jews. So eventually they found out and they came to me and they said, we're going to have a hearing, we'd like you to speak about it. Sure. So they literally, you know, gave him some type of sanction. He was relieved of his duty. My guess is he was docked of his military pay. I don't know if they put him in jail or anything like that. Stuff happens all the time. Stuff happens in the U.S. Army, too. So they have their own court system, and it stands on the law. This one, of course, like I said, a lot of times it deals with criminal and security cases on the West Bank as well. We talked about the religious courts. There are dayanim, or religious judges. Interestingly enough, they are selected by a minister of the Justice Department committee. Yeah.
So, how litigious is the society?
Wow. Getting more so all the time.
Yeah, I was going to say, based on what I know, not as much as our society. Now, keep in mind, just like in this society, anybody can sue anybody over anything. Whether or not a judge accepts to take that into court is a different matter. You know, it's more of an informal society. Yes, more so than it used to be. But
they're learning from us.
It's turning out a lot more attorneys than they are farmers at this point. I mean,
well, and they're also dealing with a lot more international business than they ever did. So there's a lot of legal stuff happening.
There's more Americans now.
What?
There's more Americans there now.
Yeah, right.
And what about crime? You know, in the criminal court system, is that?
Well, crime is definitely lower in Israel than here. You know, we talked, I don't know if you hear, there is some kind of Russian mafia crime going on. Periodically you hear about a bomb blowing up in a neighborhood and the newspaper will say a national motive was not suspected. That's code for it wasn't a terrorist, it was a Russian going after a Russian.
Supposedly more DVDs are pirated in Israel than any other country.
I haven't heard that. That's
in the world.
I'm surprised actually that China wouldn't have more of that, but you know, it's possible.
We're number one.
Yeah, it's certainly possible. So, Israel is also a society where, even with the advent of computers, more people, and certainly kids, are outside more later in the night. There's a lot of outside basketball courts and soccer courts that have lights. So, there's less kind of street crime because of that. Much more informal society.
We have a share of politicians who get cited, just like here.
Absolutely. And, by the way,
too old to play basketball.
Did you want to say something real quick about it here?
Are there any gun laws there?
Are there any gun laws there? That's a great question.
It's pretty strict, isn't it?
Very strict.
It's very strict. Of course, if you're in the Army, you have to have your gun on you at all times.
No. Besides military and police.
There are some private shooting ranges for people who have licenses. I've seen them. But it's pretty strict. They take that stuff pretty seriously. But because everybody basically knows how to use a weapon, you don't hear of as much there as you do here on a percentage basis. There are some bank robberies there. You know, you do hear about that periodically.
The idea of the right to bear arms does not exist in Israel.
Yeah, it's right, because you bear arms. Okay. There's something else I wanted to mention to you guys about the court system. All right.
We're still on the religious courts.
Oh, the religious courts. I'm sorry. We've talked about this, marital issues and what have you. There are instances when you can appeal what a religious court says to one of the other courts. And we're going to talk about that in a few minutes. There are instances. It's difficult to do. But when there are what are considered foundational issues of the law at stake, you can do that. It's very hard, but you can do that. All right, let's start on the Supreme Court, and then we'll take a break. Israel has a Supreme Court. It's a very different system than what we have here. First of all, they have 14 members. Every member does not sit on every case. Sometimes you have one member, sometimes you have three members, four or five. Sometimes you have special things. It's very rare to ever get all 14 members on the same case. This is my favorite part. Judges must retire at 70. I personally have a thing against how we do it here. I think it's ridiculous. I think that's a wonderful thing. Let these people with all their brilliance go on and do something else, hopefully for another 20 years or whatever. They are not selected by the Prime Minister. We selected by the President here. Is a council made up of lawyers, jurors, ministers, Knesset members, and legal professionals. Right? It could be a law school professor. It could be the head of the bar. In other words, people who are qualified.
Right.
How about that?
Brilliant.
What a nice system. Most cases are decided by three judges. For weightier cases, it can be expanded to 11. Right? How many do we have here? Yes, nine, yes. Hello.
Always.
Always, right.
Well, that has changed over the years. Four,
it was five.
Right. Judge
tried
two.
Right. But now it's nine, and every judge sits in on every case. I mean, literally, some are on their deathbed, and they're sitting on the case. All right. They hear petitions against the government that fall out of, that don't fit the qualifications of the other courts, which means you can make an appeal directly to Israel's Supreme Court, unlike here. And there are times when you hear of such cases, particularly West Bank Arabs, who, while they don't have the right to vote, they can appeal to the Supreme Court. They can say, Ariel Sharon's security fence, barrier, whatever you want to call it, is going on my family's land. I need it stopped right away. If you don't rule in 48 hours, they're going to bulldoze my fields, and the court's going to hear it. Now, it's probably not going to come out in your favor if it's a national defense issue, but it could. But and the important principle is that there's a place for these people to go. They don't have to spend years going through the system. That reminds me of what I was going to say earlier. We're talking about the court system. Arya Derry, you guys know who he is?
Yeah.
Who is he?
He was a politician.
He is again. Head Shah's again.
He's a member of Knesset.
He's back in Knesset. So, in 1992, Arya Derry, I think it was 92, might have been 91, was indicted for all types of fraud. Guess how long it took to get a conviction of Arya Derry?
Years.
7 years. That can be the Israeli court system, too. Right. So, it just depends. It can move very quickly. It can move very slowly. There's a lot of factors at work. All right, where are we? So, Palestinians, Druze in the Golan, there are about 30, 35,000 Druze in the Golan who are loyal to Syria. You know why they're loyal to Syria, right? After all these years, the Druze in the Golan, why would they still be loyal to Syria?
Kin in Syria?
Hmm?
Kin, their family?
Not just that.
We're not nice to them.
One day, in their mind, the Golan Heights is going to be returned. And what's going to happen to them if they paid attention to Israel? Yep. So they're hedging their bets. You know, the democracy allows me to go to the Supreme Court, but I might be back with that guy tomorrow. And they came pretty close in the year 2000. Pretty close. All right. Rulings can even halt IDF operations in the middle of an operation. One of the neat things, including in this country, is that people really respect the rule of law, right? You know, it's interesting. Nobody basically says, let's burn down the Supreme Court here or in Israel. They might protest in front of it, but the law is the law is the law. That's the principle. Unlike the U.S. court, it both hears appeals and, as we just said, has original jurisdiction. It's the first place. They're not just saying, this doesn't match our law. They're making actual rulings. They can order a retrial in a criminal matter. What do we call that here?
Double jeopardy.
Double jeopardy. No such thing in Israel. They can make a retrial if and when new information comes to light. Okay, so that was, you know, kind of all the issues from some of the crazy cases like Terry. That is rare, but it is possible. It is not unusual for them to cite Jewish law. I remember very clearly when the judge sentenced Yigal Amir. Who's Yigal Amir? He didn't just shoot Rabin, he assassinated Rabin. The man who assassinated Yitzhak Rabin, I remember very clearly, the modern Orthodox Supreme Court judge who sat there in front of the modern Orthodox Yigal Amir and read him Jewish law and told him why he was wrong. So it's very, very powerful. And one of the strengths of the system, and we're going to see there's an Israeli Arab too, is that these guys can talk, and women. Today there's a woman who is the Chief Justice, Dorit Beinisch, can talk to these people in their own language, whatever it might be. And it's a really neat and interesting system. Different than ours, has pluses and minuses, good system. Perfect timing. Let's take a break. Alright, I just wanted to mention that there have been some Israeli Arab Supreme Court judges. The first one was a guy named, and I couldn't find a picture of him, Abdel Rahman Zouabi. And he only actually had a 6-month appointment, and I couldn't figure out why. They can have certain appointments at various times. He was actually a member of the Judicial Committee of Inquiry that investigated the Baruch Goldstein thing on Purim, if you remember, in 1994, in Hebron. He is the guy, interestingly enough, who established the exclusive right of the Muslim Sharia courts to fix alimony payments. So he basically said, yes, it's law, it's legal, and he went through and proved it, that the religious courts can do this. And this is an interesting one, too, that affects all Israelis. He established the ruling that testimony of witnesses to investigators is valid even if the witness refuses to repeat the testimony in court. We don't have that. All right? Now, you can say to somebody on the witness stand, but isn't it true that you told investigators this? The person can say, I take the fifth, or for whatever reason. Or the person can lie. Doesn't matter. Next came Salim Gibran, who is actually still in the court. He's actually Christian. And he went to Hebrew University. He was in private practice for many years. He's been a judge. His expertise actually is criminal law, and he's known for a tough stance on sex and drugs, which has been a problem in some areas of Israel. We were just talking about South Tel Aviv in particular.
What's his take on rock and roll?
They were going to ask him that, but he was late for band practice. All right, a couple important rulings. In the 80s and 90s in particular, the Israeli Supreme Court, and I would argue Israeli society in general, came into its own. Right? The economy started going, particularly in the 90s. It was a more mature society. It was gelling. It was kind of getting rid of the ethos of the founding years. It was just becoming something something different. It was evolving. The court now sees itself as a protector of human rights and the secure of freedom of speech and freedom to demonstrate. Very important in Israel because the authorities can always say, national security, you can't do it. So the court stepped in on many occasions and said that's not the case. They're allowed to do that. And it's always dicey, particularly in Israel, when you do and don't do that. A couple other things, reducing military censorship. You know, the newspapers, even today, have to take certain stories to the military censor. And the military censor says, black this out, you can run this, or what have you. Much less than it was 20 years ago, but you still have to do that. And I believe Shavit mentions in his book that he showed it to the censor, if I'm correct. It might be in the back of the book. It sees its role as promoting equality between various sectors of the population. This all coincided with 1992's Basic Law of Human Dignity and Freedom,
which was an interesting law. I was reading through it. No violation of the life, body, or dignity of any person. No violation of the property of a person. So I don't know if they have eminent domain. I was looking that up. But
they don't need it. They already own everything.
Well, true. True, but I don't know the contracts of the people who, quote-unquote, rent the land. All persons are entitled to the protection of their life, body, and dignity. We could see where that could become very controversial. Section 5, no deprivation or restriction of the liberty of a person by imprisonment, arrest, extradition, or otherwise. That sounds very contradictory to me. I want to look up the further definitions of that. And finally, all persons have the right to privacy and to intimacy. That brings up all types of interesting issues in a state where a security apparatus is critically important, because wiretapping, things like that. Now, I assume you get a judge's permission for it, but it means the government has to have some oversight in what they're doing.
So, you know,
hmm?
So I don't know, for some reason, I'm not a student of what happens in Israel so much, but it seems like the Supreme Court is is more independent than the Supreme Court of the United States. And I mean, I know you explain, you know, how they qualify or who selects them to become, you know, justices. But is that true? I mean, here it's so predictable what the judges are going to say, you know, depending on
but
who they are.
But
not always. Yeah, not always.
The Supreme Court here.
Once they're confirmed, they're completely independent.
Right. They can change, they can evolve.
It's very rare, though, that somebody changes.
Well, Hugo,
you know,
there
have been a few over time.
So, you know, I would say not necessarily. I would just look at the main difference is that the Israeli Supreme Court can hear original matters, which our Supreme Court doesn't do. But our Supreme Court basically rules on previous rulings. Right? That's unconstitutional. Along these lines. These guys say, we're creating a new precedent.
Actually, there's a case that went right to the Supreme Court that took place here in Baltimore, that some fellow had his house, bought a house, and the city tore the house down next to him.
Mm-hmm.
And this guy's claiming they tore his house down also because they had done such a bad job when they tore down the one the city owned. And so, and the paper commented that it was unusual because he went right to the Supreme Court.
Do you remember when that was?
How about in today's Baltimore Sun?
Oh, really?
Yep.
Okay. I didn't see that.
But the guy disappeared.
That's. I mean, I've actually never heard that. That's very interesting.
They commented that it was very rare.
Yeah, I've never heard that.
But no one has seen or heard of this guy. Seriously, since in the last 6 months.
He's hiding out with Mayor Lansky. Yeah.
Check under the house.
Yes, but yes, on issues of national importance, I guess they can do that. Yeah, you're absolutely correct. Bush versus Gore went direct to the Supreme Court. From
federal crime.
Well, here it sounds like the individual has the opportunity to go in Israel directly to the Supreme Court.
That is correct.
You know, in major cases, maybe the Supreme Court in the United States will take it up. But for Joe Schmo,
I think they can definitely expedite.
Right, they can definitely expedite. I don't know. I wish Mark were here. He might know that, actually.
Probably.
Would they ever interfere in a ruling like Terry Schiavo? I mean, do they get into end of life kind of things of people?
Sure, they could. You could take that direct to the. Yeah, sure. Absolutely. Nothing off limits. All right. A couple of recent important rulings. I'm going to go through these pretty quickly. Interrogating prisoners. So this is very apropos of what happened in the United States over the last few days. Unanimously ruled that shaking or holding terror suspects in painful positions for a lengthy period of depriving sleep is not legal. I am sure the Shin Bet still does this. Okay, but it's illegal. So if they get caught, now look, I go over the speed limit all the time. It's illegal. Not to make a comparison.
But I'm just wondering, I mean, like a ruling like that might apply to Israeli citizens, but a lot of the Shin Bet stuff is...
My understanding was terror suspects. I actually remember it from that time.
So they don't have to be Israeli roots anymore.
Correct. Okay. Correct. That arms of the government can't do that. Agents of the government can't do that. That's my understanding. Conversions abroad. Another hot button. first non-Orthodox ruling, basically what they said is that Israeli citizens converted by conservative or reform rabbis abroad must be registered as Jews. So you can go to Cyprus and get a conservative reform rabbi. You can go to Egypt and get a conservative reform rabbi, if you can find one there.
Right.
Maybe. So that solidified what the government itself had already said. Right? It appeared out of times. It also, for now, because nothing is forever in Israel, took it off the table as far as a coalition bargaining chip for certain political parties. Targeted killings had the same issue in this country. This is 2006. Innocents were being killed in airstrikes, you know, particularly in Gaza. If it can be determined in advance that every targeted killing is prohibited according to international law, it cannot be determined in advance that every targeted killing is prohibited according to international law, as well as the reverse, each act must be considered separately. So what are they really saying? What they're saying is, and there's a lot of stuff on this that follows, what they're saying is, we're not going to make a blanket ruling. We absolutely understand there are times when you have to do targeted killings. You need to think long and thoroughly as to whether or not innocent people will be killed. Not too many years ago, there was a meeting of some Hamas heads in a four-story building in Gaza City. So the Israelis found out that these guys were going to be meeting there. They were meeting on the first floor. They decided to drop a big bomb on that building that they thought was empty at that time. Dozens of other people were killed. None of the Hamas guys were killed. So that's what this is targeting, if you'll excuse that pun.
So did anybody get, as far as I know, or maybe I just don't know, is anybody indicted? Is anybody?
That I don't know, because that's stuff that we're not going to hear about. Right, that's military, secret service.
Same thing with the Shin Bet. I
mean, exactly.
They had that case where they, on the highway.
That was in 1982. Yeah. Those guys were caught with a photograph from a newspaper.
And?
So because of that, yes, I believe they actually served some jail time for that. There was a case in 1982 where a couple terrorists took over a bus. The Israeli army said the terrorists were killed. In the raid on the bus to free the hostages, a newspaper photographer said, wait a minute, I have a picture of them being taken away. What happened here? They were beaten to death by the Israeli security service.
So I thought there'd done some kind of investigation about the bombing in Gaza, you know, recently.
Which bombing? Over the summer?
The UN facility.
Oh, the UN is doing it. The UN is doing an investigation.
Israel,
but Israel's not cooperating with the UN. They're doing their own thing.
Right, but wouldn't it fall under this?
Well, it depends on what particularly they're charged with doing. I don't think this is for particular incidents. You're talking about the bombing of the schools?
Yeah.
But all this really says is, did you think long and thoroughly about it? But yeah, that would apply there. All right, now briefly I want to get to Judge Aharon Barak. This is the guy that basically was behind all this stuff in the 80s and 90s. He's considered the most brilliant legal mind in Israel by some, and he's considered, excuse the pun again, the Antichrist by others. He was born in 36 in Lithuania. As a young boy, he was in the Kovno ghetto, so it's not an untypical story from what we've heard of some of these leaders in Israel. By 47, he made it to Palestine. He went on to study international relations, economics, and law. The Hebrew U, all three of his children are lawyers. His mother's very proud. Distinguished academic career, you can read it there. He's got a PhD, he studied here and there. In 1974, let's do the math, he was 41. He became dean of the law school. It's pretty good, the Hebrew University. 75 to 78, he was the country's attorney general. His noted decisions included prosecuting Leah Rabin. Some of you may remember she had some funds in an overseas bank account, which was illegal at that time for Israeli citizens. That law has since been revoked. It was a silly old law meant to keep all the money in the country because you weren't being a good Zionist if you had money overseas. It forced her husband to resign
1977. Then in 78, he was on the Camp David Accord negotiating team, or the legal advisor. That same year, he became the youngest judge on the Supreme Court. In 95, he was appointed president of the court. He did that, I believe, till 2013. So he had a good long run there. And I found something. Actually, let's talk about that. I'm going to see a clip on him real quickly. He's known as an activist president. That's not necessarily a dirty word in Israel for a judge. We've talked about the expansion of the types of cases the court could look at. I want to talk about, briefly, two cases, Katz versus the Regional Rabbinical Court. The bottom line is that the laws pertaining to property disputes arising from divorce are not caused by the marriage and are not regarded as matters of marriage. This is legalese. They come from an agreement between the parties, and the rabbinical courts must apply the doctrine of joint matrimonial property. What's that aimed at?
The wives get some of the,
some of the, you know, whatever. It doesn't all go to the male, basically. Here's his legacy.
But they have no effect on the get.
Correct. Don't get me started. his legacy. Amnon Rubinstein, the slouch in his own right. Thus, a situation has arisen whereby the court may convene and decide on every conceivable issue, in addition to that unreasonableness of an administrative decision will be grounds for judicial intervention. This was a total revolution in the judicial thinking which characterized the Supreme Court of previous generations, and this has given it the reputation of the most activist court in the world, causing both admiration and criticism. In practice, in many respects, the Supreme Court under Aharon Barak has become an alternate government. So this is when the court in Israel became really powerful.
I'm not totally clear on what's the criticism.
Oh, the criticism, if you're Haredi, you're going to be very upset at that. Mm-hmm. If you're certain businesses, you're going to be very upset with other rulings. Obviously didn't list all of his rulings of precedence. If you're the military and the security services, you're going to be upset he didn't say targeted killings are valid, because that ruling also left open the fact that they might not be valid. So on and so on.
But Neil, if you don't have an attorney general who enforces the law, does it not somehow diminish the efficacy of the decisions?
Well, keep in mind, the loophole is that anyone can go direct to the court, at least on certain matters. So it might not matter if an attorney general presses a case or not. Depends on the case.
When the court said that certain settlements had to be closed and abandoned, and you had some religious people who were saying, mm-hmm. Were those people arrested? Were they put in jail?
No, that becomes a political matter. So the answer is no. However, what the court usually does is it says to the government, you need to take care of this. Right? You decide how to do this. But this is what has to happen. They generally don't set deadlines, from what I've read in the past. So there's some waffle room.
Thank you.
Okay.
The court chooses what cases it wants to
Yes, hear. Absolutely.
Right, so I think the theme is that in the U.S., the court is a reluctant court. It doesn't, casts away most cases that are, people want to bring to the Supreme Court, whereas here it sounds like, at least for a period of time, they were a more friendly court as far as just hearing cases.
Well, but the numbers would make a difference to the number of cases that have come.
David raises a good point that I want to bring up one issue on that. If I'm correct, you're talking about the illegal outposts that were set up on various hilltops on the West Bank, which means without government permission. Right? There are a couple guys from this settlement going, they set that up. You're not allowed to set up a settlement without permission of the government. So Peace Now or Settlement Watch or whatever will go to the Supreme Court and say that's illegal. And the court will say, you're right, that's illegal. We charge the government with doing something about this. Now, There's another issue, by the way, with that, too. Some of those illegal settlements have water and electricity, and they can only get it from one place.
Okay.
Right. Interesting. All right. Let me show you. I found a clip that I think you'll really like of Aharon Barak. And this one goes 7 minutes. If it goes too long, I'll turn it off.
אני כתבתי הרבה פסקי דין בשל אני יהודי. לכל פסקי הדין האלה לא הבעתי את דעתי שלי, איך אני חושב שצריך להגדיר את המושג יהודי בכלל, ובחקיקה של מדינת ישראל, בעיקר בחוק השבות ובחוק האזרחות, בפרט. כידוע, המושג יהודי מופיע בטקסטים המשפטיים האלה, ויש לו הגדרה. יהודי הוא מי שנולד לאם יהודייה או שהתגייר ואינו בן דת אחרת. אז התשובה מבחינה משפטית היא פשוטה, יחסית פשוטה, משום שמה זה יהודי לעניין, מה זאת אם יהודייה ומה זה דת אחרת. אלה שאלות לא פשוטות שבית המשפט מתלבט בהן. אם אתה שואל אותי מה הוא יהודי, אז בעיניי יהודי כל מי שרואה את עצמו בתום לב כמשתייך לעם היהודי. היה זה, אני חושב, השופט אגרנט, שטבע את הביטוי שהמשפט העברי הוא המשפט הלאומי שלנו. ואני מקבל את זה. אני רואה במשפט העברי נכס צאן ברזל תרבותי שלנו. זאת יצירה אדירה שהרבה שיטות בעולם לא הגיעו עד אליה. הבעיה איתה היא שלא התפתחה מספיק, שיש לה קשיים במתן תשובה לבעיות של היום-יום, ועוד יותר יש לה קושי של הכרה, שעם ישראל לא מכיר את המשפט העברי. לכן אני גם הייתי בעד חינוך של הדור הצעיר על ברכי משפט עברי. לא נראה לי נכון הוא שלהפוך את המשפט העברי כמשפטה של המדינה. משום שעברנו דרך ארוכה מאז שהמשפט העברי היה משפטה של המדינה לפני חורבן הבית השני. בינתיים התפתחו דברים בכל העולם. ואני לא חושב שזה מעשי לבוא ולומר שהמשפט העברי יבוא במקום כל מה שיש לו. אבל אני בהחלט חושב שהמשפט העברי צריך להיות מקור השראתי כדי להבין את מה שיש לו. אבל בגלל התנאים המיוחדים, ובעיקר בגלל חוסר הידע של הציבור את המשפט העברי ואת הבסיס הנורמטיבי שלו, הבסיס הנורמטיבי של המשפט העברי הוא האמונה באל, בעוד שהבסיס הנורמטיבי של המשפט שלנו הוא האמונה באדם. אז המתח הזה לא יכול להפוך את המשפט העברי למשפט המחייב במדינה על חשבון כל השאר. אבל כדי להבין את כל מה שיש לנו, אני רואה במשפט העברי מקור פרשני חשוב מאוד. אנחנו רואים את עצמנו כמדינה יהודית, שבה יש זכות, לא רק אפשרות, זכות לכל יהודי בעולם לבוא ולומר אני אזרח ישראלי, והוא הופך מכוח הכרזתו זאת, חשיבתם לב, הוא הופך להיות אזרח ישראלי. אז אתה רואה את הקשר בינינו לבין התפוצות. אנחנו חלק מרכזי, אני חושב, של הקיום הלאומי שלנו. אבל הקיום הלאומי שלנו לא נגמר איתנו, הוא מתחיל איתנו. ולכן דיברנו על החשיבות של הקשר בין היהודים פה במדינת ישראל לבין היהודים בכל התפוצות. זה קשר בא להינתק. צריך לשמור שהוא לא יהיה נותק. בכל מקום שאני נמצא בו, שאני מסתובב בו, במדינה הזאת, אני רואה את ה-Jewish people, שיש כלל יהודים פה. רבים איתנו, לא כולם, רבים פה יהודים. והערכים הציוניים והמורשתיים הם, הם חלק מאיתנו. אבל גם כשאני נמצא בחוץ לארץ, אני מיד רואה איפה פה היהודים. אני מרגיש זר ומוזר במדינה שאין בה יהודים, שיש בה מעט מאוד יהודים. וכשגם אני נפגש עם אפילו אנשי מדע, מדע המשפט, עם שופטים, אני מחפש גם את השופט היהודי, משום שאיתו יש לי יותר משותף מאשר עם כל שופט אחר. עם כל השופטים האחרים יש את המשותף, ההיבט הדמוקרטי. איתו יש לי גם את ההיבט היהודי. כך שאני מאמין גדול ב-Jewish peoplehood ובעתיד של ה-Jewish peoplehood, אבל צריך לעבוד בשביל זה. זה לא בא לבד. אני חסיד גדול של אור לגויים. אני חושב שהיינו בעבר אור לגויים. הבאנו את האמונה באל אחד. יש לך אור גדול יותר שאפשר להביא לעולם כולו מאשר האמונה באל אחד. זה התנ"ך. זה אור גדול מאוד. ואני חושב שאנחנו יכולים להיות אור לגויים. הגניוס היהודי והגניוס הישראלי. של יהודים ושלא יהודים. כל אלה ביחד בהחלט יכולים, אני מאמין, להיות אור לגויים. ואור לגויים לא רק בזה שאנחנו נעשה סטארט-אפים שיהיו מוצלחים מאוד מאוד, אם כי גם זה חשוב מאוד, אלא גם אור לגויים בקידום ערכים של צדק, של מוסר, בקידום זכויות. אני חושב שבית המשפט העליון שלנו הוא בהחלט אור לגויים בהבנת המושג כבוד האדם. אנחנו הבנו אותו באופן מלא יותר, מפותח יותר, עשיר יותר, מאשר רוב מדינות העולם. ולכן אני בהחלט בעד זה שנמשיך להיות עולם. תודה, ואני מודה על, על הפרס שבא לי כהפתעה, אבל יש הפתעות נעימות. אני מודה על כך.
Alright, so you can see why he is both revered and not revered. But he's an interesting guy. He's obviously a very bright guy, to say the least.
What personally
prize
the
did
word?
He win?
What?
Israeli prize? The Israel prize?
I think it was the Israel prize. I didn't look, to be honest with you. I just liked the beginning of it. but he hits on a lot of the themes that we've been talking about. What a surprise. We're running short on time based on the amount of material I prepared. So let's talk about the Israel Defense Forces. It has its roots, as we've talked about, in 1910. Some people basically got together in the Galilee and formed a group called HaShomer, or the Guardian, or the Watchman. And what they did was watch the fields to make sure that Arabs weren't taking away some of their, you know, crops or stealing their animals or what have you. About 10 years later, the Haganah, which means the defense, came into being. It significantly boosted itself in the 1930s, late 1930s with the Arab Revolt. Eventually it became the Israel Defense Forces, or the IDF. That was in 1948, becomes a conscript army. This obviously should be reversed. All men is 3 years and all women are 2 years. There is an opt-out, which we spoke about last week, for religious women as well as for Arabs. The Druze and the Bedouin serve, but it is not mandatory. The Bedouin in particular are known as great trackers. They're the ones that can, you know, find where somebody was running through a field or something like that. And the Druze are very distinguished service to the State of Israel. Tragically, we know from the synagogue in Har Nof a few weeks ago, it was a Druze policeman who was murdered. And the President of Israel spoke at his funeral very movingly, as some of you saw that. Core values of the IDF, according to the IDF, is defense of the state and its citizens and residents. Why would they call it the Israel Defense Forces and not just the Army of Israel?
Supposedly they respond, they don't initiate.
Right.
And it's obviously always an interesting debate because, by the way, in Jewish law, you're obligated to defend yourself, so you should act first. You know, so and if somebody, it's the whole thing. Somebody breaks in your house before the sun comes up. It's a whole philosophical thing. Love of the homeland and loyalty to the country and human dignity. The underlying value we just talked about, it's not offensive, but defensive. Something called Taharat HaNeshek, or the purity of the arms. We respect our weapons. Our weapons aren't meant to kill, they're meant to defend. They're meant to protect. There's a lot of informality. You rarely see salutes. It's not uncommon, particularly when you deal with reservists, for commanding officers to be a lot younger than some of the people who were then under them. But you're also encouraged in the Israeli army, when you're having these various meetings in the field, to speak up and basically say, no, commanding officer, you're wrong, because it's that hill that the map says we're supposed to go over. Can you do that in the U.S. Army?
Not quite.
You can, right, exactly. You can do it, but you're going to pay a price. It's a much more informal operation in some regards, because these guys have been together for a long time, particularly the reservists, until, depending what you're doing, in your early 40s, various years, you get together for around a month a year, which is, by the way, a huge sacrifice. You're running a business, you know, bye-bye, it's February. You know, I'll be home on the weekend, and I'm trying to do all my work then. The weekend, of course, being Friday midday when I get home, till Saturday night.
Mamlachtiot.
It's all right. Very good. Very good. You passed the quiz.
Thank you.
The Israeli army is the great nation builder. It takes all these people from all over the place, and it brings them together. And for some of them, they're learning Hebrew. And if you're Ethiopian, you know, it's really a new experience to you. So it's a big melting pot. For particularly in the early decades of the country, a big job of the army was to teach people Hebrew and the society. They went and did assistance in the various refugee camps, the Jewish refugees, that is, that came in from Arab lands, in the Ma'abarot, they were called. Even today, if you go to Israel, and I'm sure some this happened to some of you, you go to Yad Vashem, you go to the Knesset, you go wherever, you see groups of soldiers, right? And what are they doing? They're on educational trips. And guess what? Some of them have never been to Yad Vashem. And some of them might not have ever been in a synagogue before, but I've literally seen them all over Israel. And it's a great thing. And by the way, few of them know as much Zionist history as you know. That's not a joke.
That is true. And
yeah.
I just had several experiences like that myself.
Tell one.
I told people I went to the David Ben-Gurion house. Almost everybody I said that to said they had never been there.
Right.
And that the last time that a lot of people were at the Hebrew Museum, for example, was when they were in high school.
Right, right.
So they don't know the country like you would think, almost as well. I think we know it better. A lot of this history.
Yeah.
That's correct.
Now, depends on who you are, depends on where you grew up. Grew up in certain neighborhoods in Jerusalem, you know, in your
maybe
Jerusalem
so, yeah.
Educational system. You take field trips, you go to the Israel Museum. But you live in Haifa, you know, who knows? All right.
Or you're the yeshiva.
Right. Absolutely. All right. The army is divided into several tracks. We talked already about the Chesed Yeshiva, which is where you split the military service with the religious service, or yeshiva's years. What I want you to know, that, and we did briefly mention it, there's a Haredi Hesder yeshiva that's getting underway now. It has about 14 guys in it, I think. There's something called Nachal, which they still have, but doesn't really meet its original purpose anymore, which was to set up communities. The goal was you would be in the army for 3 years with a bunch of people, then you would basically stay at a place and open up a kibbutz, or a moshav.
If you don't mind, one other story. I had a young officer from Nachal stay with me one time, and I live out in Owings Mills, and he said to me, how come you don't have a farm here? You have all this land. Why don't you have a farm?
Sheirut Lumi, particularly modern Orthodox women, do national service for a year or two. David had mentioned that his granddaughter, I think she taught in one of the development towns.
Yeah, and she also worked for the Israeli FEMA.
Oh, that's right. I remember that, actually.
I think that's what my daughter-in-law did.
Reserve duty we talked about. Mitch, I'm going to have to skip the lone soldiers. If we have time, we'll come back to it. There's great stuff online. If you want to go to YouTube and type in Friends of Israel Defense Forces or just lone soldier, it's about the Americans primarily who go serve in Israel and, you know, and how the army takes care of them. By the way, David Schoenfeld might be coming to my house tomorrow night.
Oh, right.
He's going back to Israel in a couple days.
Right. Tell him I said
hi. I will. I will. I just learned that tonight.
One other thing as far as the IDF. It's kind of unique. It is pretty much apolitical, right, which is unique for Israel.
Yes, yes. The soldiers and the officers, at least, generally do not speak out. If you're a chief of staff and you speak out politically in Israel, you're going to be in trouble. They generally keep their mouths shut on these matters. So you're absolutely right. Unless they're kind of a few weeks away from retiring and they're trying to get into a political party. Anybody remember the cool-off period for politicians? For army guys before you can go into the military?
Three years.
Doesn't mean you can't do other things like be national security advisor, which Netanyahu has as well. The education system. I'm not going to read everything up here. Basically, what we know is that the challenge was, again, how do you create something new? How do you reframe Jewish history? How do you put it into a Zionist value system? And how do you make it modern? You have to start from scratch. There's a whole bunch of stuff on Yemenites and how difficult it was for them to integrate. There have been many efforts to centralize education in Israel. Like everything else, education early on became a political football in Israel. Various government commissions have been formed. They did make a conscious decision to inject into the secular school system a study of Judaism and Jewish values. They've relooked at that many times, including most recently in the early 90s with something that was called the Shenhar Commission that Yitzhak Rabin was very much in favor of and promoting, and then unfortunately we know what happened. But they did other things too. They said no youth groups in schools, no ideology in schools. You can't fly the red flag anymore. No more socialist stuff. Right? May Day was a big thing in Palestine and then Israel. No more. Mamlachtiyut. Right? But under pressure, Ben-Gurion kept the religious tracts separate. And we're about to see what that did. There are educational tracks in Israel. There's the national track. Good news is, and based on what Avraham Barak was saying, the last study I saw was the late 90s, about half of the secular Jews wanted Jewish education for their children. Now, when you consider that this was a time when most of the Russian immigrants had come in, that's a really good number. Because they didn't know. There's a religious national track, which are kind of like the modern Orthodox day schools that we have in this country. Primarily good schools, half-day religious, half-day secular matters. Anybody ever hear of the Tali schools? What do you know about them?
I can't remember what, I've heard it, but I can't remember what they are.
So the Tali schools were actually started by the conservative movement. The conservative movement thought that this would be great. You inculcate Jewish values and Jewish history in a meaningful way into the lives of a lot of these kids, particularly secular kids, and they were known as very quality schools. Cost a little money to go there. You can, particularly when you get to high school can cost money in Israel. I don't quite want to say they're private schools, but they're kind of like that. The Tali school wanted to get money from the government to spread. The Tali schools, so they basically decided to divest themselves from the conservative movement because they knew the government would never fund it. So now there's still a chain of Tali schools in Israel. They're not Orthodox, but they're kind of religious. It's kind of hard to explain. Look what happened to the Haredi schools. 1948, 5,000 students. 1998, 200,000. Big issue in Israel, we might have mentioned a few weeks ago. It's been said that by the year 2020 or so, 50% of the first grade students in Israel will be Orthodox or Arab, Haredi or Arab. 50% non-Zionist. Big issue. Numbers change. That's where it's at today. And again, I think Shavit goes into that in his book a little bit. There's an Arab track. It's in Arabic. They know Hebrew from growing up in Israel, but there's a separate Arab track. And I talked about the Shenhar Commission. So you really have national, religious national, Haredi, and Arab. Four separate educational tracks. I once heard Rabbi Michael Melchior, who's a Haredi rabbi who's very liberal in his political and social views, say that he thinks it was the greatest mistake the country ever made was to have separate educational tracks. Because he said the non-religious need to know more, and the religious need to know more. He said, but now it's too late. I'm going to skip that. Just a moment on Arab education. By the end of, or here, in 1948, about 30% of the Arab children were in schools. They were out in the fields. There were 10 Arab high schools and 2 for girls, not one college. So this is one of the things the State of Israel has done very well for all of its citizens. By the end of 1949, a year later, there were now 69 Arab schools, right, up from 10. By 1959, there were 150 Arab schools. By 1999, there were 550 Arab schools. And that's something to be proud of. And this is some references to the laws. What do Arab schools teach? They teach standard subjects, but they don't teach Zionist history. They don't teach Jewish history. Right? You can take Arabic, by the way, in Israeli Jewish schools. You know, my nephew took some Arabic. There are massive issues still in the Arab schools. The teaching is just not as good. They don't get as much money per child. They have a shortage of classroom and facilities. There's a shortage of preschools. And the dropout rate is too high. So there are issues. So there are many things to be proud of, and there are things to work on. I'm not going to show it to you guys tonight, but there's a village in the south of Israel called Neve Shalom Wahat al-Salam. Is anybody familiar with it? So, it's an Arab-Jewish school where Jewish kids and Israeli-Arab kids, the village is split, learn together. And it's the only one of its type in Israel. It's generally seen as a pretty successful operation.
Is that the one that was attacked?
Yes, unfortunately. Yes. Not so long ago.
What was the question?
Is that the one that was attacked?
It was an arson.
Yeah.
Yeah.
All right, I'm going to close out tonight by talking a little bit about the president of Israel and then showing you, I mentioned to you a few weeks ago, this great video of Shimon Peres. And it's just in time because my voice just went south. The president is the de jure head of state. Right? He does and doesn't have any power. There's been no female president yet, so. And here's the list of the presidents. That's why I say he. It's a ceremonial law, a rule. I said the prime minister signs the laws before. I'm sorry. The president signs the laws. Your new ambassador, present. No matter who comes to Israel on a state visit, they go see the president first. He has, let's say, bully pulpit instead of more pulpit. The president can and does speak out of issues of social matter, of Jewish matter, of unity matters, the president would never speak out and say, you know, that war in Gaza was the wrong thing, or we should have done more on that war in Gaza. Off the table. Reuven Rivlin is the president now. He's the past speaker of the Knesset. He is known for being a fastidious believer in democracy. He was a Likud lawmaker, but he is a real believer in democracy. Uniter of the nation, he can pardon or commute prisoners. He can make some appointments. There's a couple state-owned companies still. Yeah.
He signs every law, but he doesn't have veto power.
Correct. He literally just signs every law. That's it. That is correct.
Really the secretary.
I said 40. It's 45. It's 42 days that he gives people the right to form a government. If you can't form your government in 42 days, he'll go to the party with the next highest number of seats. If that keeps happening, he'll say, we have to go to new elections. Hasn't happened yet, but there have been some close elections. All right, let me show you my all-time favorite Israel video. And we will wind up, this is Shimon Peres, the Imida Pes president of Israel. You've been president of Israel. You've spent 7 decades in the service of the state. What do you do now?
Time to drop in the
new car sales. Yeah, that's right, used cars.
The most exciting event of the season is going on now. Shop at ShoesNissan.com and click now for great local offers like this.
Whoops.
I'm Danny Schmokin.
אדוני הנשיא, סיימת כבר לארוז?
אני עובד על זה.
מצוין. חשבת מה אתה לא לעשות ביום שאחרי?
גם על זה אני עובד.
אוקיי, אז איזה ניסיון יש לך?
הייתי רפתן במדרגה ראשונה.
הכל עכשיו חליבה אוטומטית.
הייתי גם רואה צאן, ולא איבדתי אף כבשה.
עכשיו כולם טבעונים.
הייתי שר דואר. גם דואר נכנס וגם דואר יוצא.
עכשיו הכל במייל.
אני הקמתי את רפאל.
מה זה מסעדה הזו? למה ככה יקר? תגיד.
זה לא המסעדה, זה רשת לפיתוח המסעדה.
אני אראה לך ניסיון. תחפש משהו. תקווה לטוב.
שלום, 95 מלא.
שמן מים?
לא תדע.
9 שישיות מים ו-20 שקלים?
אני לא מעוניין.
אתה רוצה נוזל ולהתביש משות?
אני לא מעוניין.
מחצלת לקמפינג אולי?
טוב, בוא נתקדם.
בסדר. ערכת קריוקי?
אני לא מעוניין, אוקיי?
מה, צופים דורה?
לא, אפשר לשלם?
שמע, אם תמשיך להגיד לא לכל הצעה, תשלם מחיר כבד.
טוב, תביא את המצופים.
סלי, שלום. זה הפתרון היחידי.
שלום.
נשק יש?
לא.
האינטלקט הוא הנשק הטוב ביותר. רובי סער יש?
לא.
כוונת צלפים?
לא, מה פתאום?
טיל בליסטי נגד צפונות?
לא.
מצוין. ננו טכנולוגיה היא העתיד. כנס.
תודה.
רוצה עוד משהו?
לא, תודה רבה.
רוצה לשמוע קצת על מבצעים?
כן.
כשיצאנו למבצע אנטבה, הכל היה לוד בערפל. לא ידענו היכן החוטפים, היכן החטופים, והיינו צריכים לשמור...
He was Minister of Defense.
‫בשפקת מוחלטים.
‫אמרו 45 דקות, אבל כבר כמעט שעה.
‫הדרך אמנם קצרה מאוד, ‫אבל קריצתה הייתה כל כך קשה, מצער.
‫תודה.
‫רגע, מה עם טיפ? ‫טיפ, עם שאינו מבט תקווה, נותן טיפים, לא לוקח טיפים.
אחלה.
וגם יקבל לחם שום כפיצוי.
מעולה. תודה רבה.
היי, תודה תודה. ועכשיו, קבלו את הכוכב הבא. קבלו את שימי פי.
מכירים את זה שאתם מקימים מפעל טקסטיל בנגב וכולם חושבים שזה משהו אחר?
דימונה.
יש פה מישהו מדימונה? הדבר הזה עובד בכלל?
המדריך, אני לא חושב שאני מסוגל לעשות את זה.
רוזוולט אמר, הדבר היחידי שעלינו לפחד ממנו זה הפחד עצמו.
כן, אבל אני לא יכול.
תראה כמה יפה ארצנו.
מקסים, אבל אני באמת לא יכול.
העתיד שייך למי שמעז.
You see the whole country.
קדימה, יש עוד הרבה עבודה.
מה זה, אין פה כלום.
כשאין כלום, אפשר לעשות הכל.
That's a lot of fun, and I wanted to show that in particular because we spend a lot of time talking about the difficulties, and there's a lot of tremendously good things, and a sense of humor is one of them. And Perez, we could do a whole course on him. You know, he's had so many twists and turns in his life, it's amazing. 90 years old, served the Jewish people for 70-some years.
Never won an election.
Never won an election, other than for the head of labor.
Okay.
That's right. Guys, everybody have a great night.
Thank you.
Thank you, Neil.
My pleasure. Thank you, guys.
Thank you.
Thank you.